Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
There is a deal to be had here, but it has to be born from facts, real math, local impact data.
Governor Dunleavy wants a property tax break for the gas line project, but local leaders aren't convinced. From Alaska Public Media, this is statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, December 19th. Good evening, I'm Wesley Early. Also tonight, the Alaska rural-urban divide when it comes to Christmas dinner is stark.
The menu includes turkey, as well as ham and in Nome versus Anchorage. Those are about 2 to 4 times the cost per pound.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly. Governor Mike Dunleavy is eyeing a property tax break for the long-planned Alaska LNG project. As Alaska Public Media's Eric Stone reports, the proposal is drawing pushback from legislators and local officials.
Dunleavy's tax proposal would give the project a 90% discount on the state's normal property tax for oil and gas infrastructure. He described his plans in an interview with the Anchorage Daily News. The Republican governor's spokesperson confirmed the proposal, but declined to make Dunleavy or another member of the administration available for an interview. The state shares oil and gas property tax revenue with local governments, and some local leaders are raising concerns about Dunleavy's proposal.
We can't subsidize that project. We at least have to cover our costs.
That's Kenai Peninsula Borough Mayor Peter Michicki. He says he expects the project would be a boon for the state, and he says a natural gas export terminal would likely bring thousands of jobs to the Kenai Peninsula. But he says a low property tax rate for the project would essentially push some of the project's cost onto local taxpayers.
We're going to have impacts on our schools. We're going to have impacts on emergency services. For sure, we're likely going to be the agencies they turn to for their emergency response plans, like all of the other oil and gas facilities do.
Plans for a North Slope gas pipeline and an export terminal in South Central Alaska have been in the works for years, but they've taken on new life in the second Trump administration. The state has turned over the project to a private developer, Glenfarne, which has put out a steady stream of announcements about agreements with possible customers, investors, and suppliers. But the project has plenty of skeptics, too, who argue that the project, last estimated at $44 billion, would be too expensive to make financial sense. A consulting firm contracted by the state legislature to examine the project, Gaffney Klein, told lawmakers last month they may need to make a variety of changes to help the pipeline become a reality, including changes to property taxes. In a statement, a spokesperson for project developer Glenfarne said the company had not seen the specifics of Dunleavy's proposal and couldn't offer an opinion. Michicki says he's open to tax breaks that would support a pipeline, but he says local governments need to be involved in determining what exactly those might be. And at least so far, he says that hasn't happened.
There is a deal to be had here. But it has to be born from facts, real math, local impact data. It has to be transparently and fairly negotiated between all involved in good faith.
In an email, Dunleavy spokesperson Jeff Turner said the bill hadn't yet been drafted, so he said it's premature to say the proposal was developed without their input. And he said essentially that the proposed deal is better than nothing. The state and municipalities are currently making no money on an LNG pipeline because it doesn't exist. Fairbanks Representative Maxine Dybert, a Democrat who co-chairs the State House Resources Committee, says she plans to discuss Dunleavy's bill with local officials. But she says she plans to focus much of her attention this session on a separate bill that would require the project to include a smaller lateral pipeline to supply Fairbanks with gas to cut energy costs.
And for me, that is a line in the sand that it needs to be guaranteed part of the project.
Republican Senator Jesse Bjorkman, who represents the Central Kenai Peninsula, says he's on the fence about Dunleavy's proposal. He says he'd like to learn more about the project's finances to determine what's necessary. But in any case, he says it would make little sense to cut the project to break on property taxes after Glenfarne makes a final investment decision, or FID.
If they're going to have an FID decision in January next month, then that cake is already baked. Like, the financials are already in place.
Glenfarne declined to say when exactly it expects to make a final investment decision on the pipeline. That's essentially the formal green light for the project. The company says it's, quote, rapidly progressing towards a final investment decision and that the project remains on schedule to deliver its first gas to Alaskans in 2029. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Eric Stone.
The state is in the early stages of crafting a new plan to guide decisions about Southeast Alaska Transit for the next 2 decades. During 2 virtual open houses this week, residents raised a long list of specific projects and broader issues. As Avery Elfelt reports for the Alaska Desk, many comments revolved around more reliable ferry service and the controversial Cascade Point Ferry Terminal project.
The State Department of Transportation and Public Facilities says it will draft a plan for Southeast by the end of summer 2026 and finalize it by this time next year. The document will cover all communities from Yakutat to Metlakatla. The new version would mark the first complete overhaul in more than 20 years, says Jill Melcher, DOT's South Coast Planning Chief.
The last adopted plan was in 2004, and an unofficial update was done in 2014 that captured changes over 10 years. Our region has changed significantly since 2014, and it's time for an update.
Agency staff say that in the early stages, a handful of themes have already emerged. They range from ferry reliability to resiliency amid climate change. Now, the state is asking for public input, both via email and during town halls. The agency held 2 virtual ones this week. Mike Jackson in Cake raised sporadic ferry service in his community. He said the state has said Cake rarely gets ferries, in part because its terminal can't accommodate larger ships. He said there's been talk about updating the terminal with new catwalks to change that.
So that is one of the things we talked about doing here. But if there's a way to better serve Cake somehow, we sure would appreciate it.
Participants also talked about the need for float plane dock maintenance and more airport parking. One raised the need for restoring ferry service from Ketchikan to Prince Rupert, British Columbia. Haines local Patty Brown asked about the state's ongoing study of what it would cost to build a road on the west side of the Lynn Canal to, at least in theory, better connect Haines and Skagway to Juneau. She wanted to know how that might be incorporated into the 20-year plan. South Coast Region Director Christopher Goins replied that the study would wrap up in January.
Based on that, we'll look at the data, work with this team, and depending on what we see from leadership, include or not include that going forward.
But it was a related project that kept coming up during the town hall, the Cascade Point Ferry Terminal. The state says building a new terminal north of Juneau would cut costs and ease travel between Haines, Skagway, and the capital city. The idea has drawn fire from residents in all 3 communities who say the state should prioritize improving ferry service instead. When Wendy Anderson of Skagway made that point in the town hall's virtual chat, Goins responded that the agency does believe the terminal would reduce travel times. Otherwise, he stressed that Cascade Point would not replace the Auk Bay terminal for most passengers.
There will be mainline service that continues up once a week. What is moving would be the trips to Haines and Skagway from Cascade Point.
At least 2 other comments came in regarding Cascade Point. One asked about funding for the project. The other dubbed the planned terminal a, quote, shameful waste of taxpayer dollars. Agency staff and contractors thanked participants for their comments and encouraged the public to keep them coming. Comments can be submitted at seatp@dowl.com. Reporting in Haines, I'm Avery Elfelt.
The Alaska Department of Corrections has reported 18 people have died in custody of the state's prisons and jails so far this year, on par with the state's highest death count in 2022. The Alaska Beacon reports advocates and lawmakers say the number is both devastating and preventable. DOC officials, through a spokesperson, declined to comment on the number of deaths. The ACLU is calling for the reinstatement of an independent oversight body to investigate the circumstances of in-custody deaths and reduce risks. The state created a special internal investigative unit in DOC in 2016, following a 2015 report that widespread failures and dysfunction within the system led to at least 6 in-custody deaths. But the unit was dissolved in 2018 during budget cuts under the Dunleavy administration. The ACLU is also calling for changes in Alaska law to allow more people who are elderly and with terminal illnesses to be released on medical and geriatric parole. Most recently, DOC reported the death of Kane Huff, age 46, on December 15th in Goose Creek Correctional Center. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Fairbanks City Council will now start regular meetings with a land acknowledgement.
It's the right thing to show our community that we are one together with the Alaska Native community.
That's ahead. Stay with us. Christmas presents may be arriving later than expected for many rural communities in Alaska. That's after Alaska Air Cargo, Alaska Airlines cargo-specific carrier, placed an embargo on freight shipments for several hubs across the state: Nome, Kotzebue, Bethel, Dillingham, and Utqiagvik. According to Alaska Airlines, the embargo began on December 16th and will end on December 21st. The embargo excludes Alaska Air Cargo's Gold Streak shipping service, designed for smaller packages and parcels, as well as live animals. Alaska Airlines spokesperson Tim Thompson cited unexpected freighter maintenance and severe weather impacting operations as causes for the embargo. With the holiday just a week away, carriers like Northern Air Cargo have rushed to fill the gap. Ice is starting to block channels at Homer Harbor, limiting access for some boats. And as KBBI's Simon Lopez reports, that's an ongoing concern with cold temperatures in the forecast.
Drifting ice is reshaping access at Homer Harbor, with sheets blowing in from Mud Bay at the base of the spit. And one worry is that wind and tides can turn a clear channel into an ice blockade in just a few hours. Homer Harbor Master Matt Clark says that congestion affects vessels differently. A steel crabber might push through easily, while fiberglass skiffs can get stuck when the outgoing tide packs the ice together.
Conversely, on the ebb, as the amount of surface area of water that is present, like in the channel entrance, diminishes, some of that ice condenses and it gets more difficult to force your way through.
Seawater ice in the harbor is usually soft enough to support a boat, officials say. Clark warns the real danger is internal, like a vessel's plumbing that pulls seawater in for cooling. If those lines aren't winterized, the water inside them can freeze and burst the pipe. That damage often goes unnoticed until the weather warms up, the ice plug melts, and the boat begins to flood. Deputy Harbormaster Aaron Glidden says the safest way to avoid freeze damage is to pull boats out of the water for winter. But the launch ramp can become impassable at low tide, making that difficult.
It becomes sometimes unusable, depending on how much ice is made, and like the ice will come in on the high tide and then it'll get deposited on the ramp as the tide recedes.
Glidden says crews use loaders to clear the ramp when possible. Boaters can check the harbor entrance webcam on the city's website, but Clark warns conditions change quickly and urges anyone moving a boat to call the harbor office first. Meanwhile, temperatures are supposed to dip into the teens within the next week, meaning the ice issue might not go away anytime soon. In Homer, I'm Simon Lopez.
The amount of money Alaskans pay for food greatly depends on where they live. What does that up to during the holidays? Mike Jones is an economist with the University of Alaska Anchorage's Institute of Social and Economic Research, whose work focuses on food systems and security. He was interested in the cost difference of a holiday meal between Anchorage and rural Alaska. To calculate that, Jones collected prices from stores in Anchorage and Nome using a holiday menu from the American Farm Bureau. He told Alaska Public Media's Ava White that the same meal costs over 130% more in Nome versus Anchorage.
Across the full menu, we saw an Anchorage price come in at about $77 for a large family dinner, and Nome came in significantly higher at $177.45. We see a lot of main differences in the meat protein. So the menu includes turkey as well as ham, and in Nome versus Anchorage, those are about 2 to 4 times the cost per pound. And we also see some pretty significant differences in frozen goods included in the menu, as well as the produce. But it's really, really expensive to eat whole fruits and vegetables, especially fresh fruits and vegetables in rural Alaska. It's hard to get it out there. And frankly, it is a food security question.
Is it simply the logistics and refrigeration driving up those costs, or are there other factors that contribute to those higher prices?
All of our remote off-road communities, even including a hub like Nome, are very hard to get to. And anytime you're transporting something by air, it's going to be more expensive. We also see a lot of really big challenges in rural Alaska getting food to survive the journey. So we've done a lot of mapping of food spoilage across the state, and Nome is no exception. You see big spikes in produce that is lost, as in has to get thrown away the second it gets to the store, particularly in the winter. So that sort of builds into the cost. The other thing that's worth mentioning is it's just expensive to run a store in off-road Alaska.
In rural Alaska, or I guess Alaska in general, subsistence is obviously a really big thing here. Do you think a lot of families swap out the turkey and ham for maybe a traditional subsistence food?
Menus for families, especially around holidays, are a very cultural thing. And I would absolutely imagine, given the diversity in this state, that we would see different menus for Christmas all over the state. And particularly in off-road communities where you have a lot of wild food collection, a lot of per capita wild food consumption, I would imagine if the ham and the turkey is 2 to 4 times the cost, it's the some of the most expensive, you know, price comparisons, that would be ripe for substituting for wild foods. Plus, people might prefer, even if it was the same price, to be eating wild proteins versus store-bought proteins.
So, you know, it's common knowledge that everything costs more in rural Alaska, but does looking at it through a holiday lens reveal anything about food insecurity or?
You know, the holidays that we're talking about, whether it's Thanksgiving or Christmas meals that we're highlighting, they're falling in a really difficult time for supply chains in rural Alaska, a particularly difficult time. You know, you get these surges, and after the PFD, there's a big surge in demand, and it puts a lot of strain on lift capacity or the number of planes that you can move out. You only have so many planes and so many people working so many hours a day. And then Christmas and Thanksgiving, you have big demand rushes, a lot getting pushed through because there's a lot of people buying things. And so you have a lot of strain on that system. That's coupled with a couple different things as well, which is, you know, December 22nd, I believe, is the winter solstice. That is the least amount of light that we're going to have. And light matters in aviation. You need to be able to see, especially when you're flying under visual flight rules. And so if we're thinking in particular flights out from the hub villages off-road to the, or from the hub communities out to the villages, that can matter a lot. And so you have less hours to fly. You have a lot getting pushed through the system. And you get a lot of shock on the runway. If you're loading a plane or unloading a plane, and if goods, especially perishables, are sitting there for 2 hours at 20 below, or even 30 minutes at 20 below, that's a big deal. And you're probably going to see that reflected in rates of spoilage, which we do see in the data, and probably the quality of what's on the shelf as well.
Mike Jones is an economist with UAA's Institute of Social and Economic Research. The Fairbanks City Council approved an ordinance Monday to establish a standing verbal land acknowledgement at the beginning of regular meetings. The measure passed in a narrow vote, and it comes after the same proposal got voted down earlier this year. That was before the municipal election in October, and as KUAC's Patrick Gilchrist reports, a change in the mayor's seat between then and now proved decisive.
The land acknowledgement is 59 words and starts like this.
We respectfully acknowledge the Dene people upon whose traditional lands we reside.
That's Councilmember Valerie Therrien. Here's the rest.
We honor the Dene who have been the stewards of interior lands and waters for centuries. The elders who have lived here before, the Dene people of today and future generations to come. We also recognize that Alaska Native people would traditionally gather here and harvest Native foods.
Therrien started voluntarily reading those words into the record as a matter of routine after a city council meeting in May. That's when a previous ordinance that would have codified the practice failed to advance past its first reading. David Prues, who was mayor at the time, broke a 3-3 council tie by casting a no vote. On Monday, the vote was 4-3 again, but this time in favor of the ordinance. Every council member held on to their seat following this year's municipal election in October, but Mayor Mindy O'Neill beat Prues in the city mayoral race. And on Monday, the 6 council members voted the same way they had in May, meaning O'Neill's tie-breaking yes vote was the difference. Here she is at the meeting.
This is the right thing to do. It's the right thing to show our community that
We are one together with the Alaska Native community, and that government exists for everyone.
The vote followed testimony from about a dozen people, almost all of whom supported the measure. That included leaders from local Native organizations, such as Tanana Chiefs Conference, Dinakanaga, and Fairbanks Native Association. TCC Chief and Chairman Brian Ridley says the words don't assign blame or rewrite history.
It simply recognizes it. It honors the original stewards of this land and the cultural continuity of the Athabascan people who are still here, contributing to the strength and well-being of Fairbanks every single day.
Council members who were opposed to the idea said the acknowledgments language is already displayed outside the council chambers. And they said reading it by choice during meetings, as Therian has been, means more than when doing so is required by code. Those who voted no, like Councilmember John Ringstad, also said the city should focus on more practical matters for improving the city's relationship with its Alaska Native population.
What we need to do is work on our problems. We need to talk. There's no reason we can't do that. It doesn't have to be at a formal meeting. In my mind, I'd rather actually do some substantive work rather than symbolism.
Ringstad pointed to an upcoming measure as something he likes. It proposes creating a monthly spot on the agenda for the council to receive reports from Alaska Native organizations. Council members who supported the land acknowledgement ordinance said they appreciated that idea too, but viewed the two measures as complementary rather than commensurable. In Fairbanks, I'm Patrick Gilchrist.
In the weeks since Typhoon Halong hit Western Alaska, aid has come in the forms of subsistence food donations, donated clothing, and contributions to relief funds. KYUK's Samantha Watson reports how one writer looked to her creative gifts when searching for a way to help those who had lost everything.
When writer Lonnie Holes heard the news about Typhoon Halong, she was across the country in Hawaii, where she lives.
I couldn't help but with each video that I watched online, people posting about the disaster and afterwards, I just could not just sit there. I was like, there's something I can do.
Holes was in the middle of writing a novel, part of a journey to reconnect with her Yupik culture. The author, who spent periods of her upbringing in Bethel, has family roots in the Yukon Delta village of Kotlik, which suffered damage from the October storm. Her father was also a principal across schools in the region, including Kipnuk.
I was like, wait, I could do something creative and connect with a nonprofit and get something rolling. Something physical that's positive and connects to my culture as well.
Holes began coordinating with the Alaska Community Foundation to host a fundraising sale of the children's book she was inspired to write. It's called Anuk, A Meyer Sunset, and 50% of each sale goes directly to the Western Alaska Disaster Relief Fund to support families impacted by Typhoon Halong. The storybook was inspired by a moment Holes experienced with her son, Ashton. At the end of a stressful day, Holes says the two went for a drive.
During the drive, the most captivating sunset caught my attention. And I paused and I was like, oh my gosh. I was like, Ashton, look at that sunset. It's so beautiful. And my son was quiet for a second and he asked, am I your sunset? I lost my breath for a moment.
Hull says the book came from this seed of connection and meaning between parent and child. The story follows the layout of a poem, an adult responding to a child asking the same question in a backdrop of Yupik culture.
And then each page, it's almost like a poem, goes over like, yes, you are my sun, you are my moon, and there's lots of culturally significant imagery in there as well. Like eating salmon berries, tundra tea, as well as like fishing and northern lights.
Hull says she hopes the book will find buyers and anyone looking to support relief efforts. But she also hopes copies find their way into the hands of those affected by the typhoon. the book features a journal section where families can record memories shared together.
I can't imagine what these families are going through right now. And I wanted to bring something positive and to their life. The main part of this story is what matters most is family moments with your family, these sweet moments throughout your day.
You can find a copy of Anuk M.I.R. Sunset at Barnes & Noble Booksellers online. In Bethel, I'm Samantha Watson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Eric Stone in Juneau, Avery L. Felton Haynes, Ben Townsend in Nome, Simon Lopez in Homer, Ava White in Anchorage, Patrick Gilchrist in Fairbanks, and Samantha Watson in Bethel. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Crystal Hyde. Annie Fight helped produce tonight's show. And I'm Wesley Early. Have a great weekend.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.